ready.
Okay, it's recording.
Well, good morning on this Shabbat, post-Purimi, I guess we could call it. Which, by the way, is the adjective people use today, Purimi. You can be invited to a Mesiba Purimit.
Okay.
For those who don't speak Hebrew, a Purimish party.
Awesome.
And we are going to continue, in a sense, we were looking at the book of Esther last week in honor of the holiday. And we started with the first two chapters, of which we didn't make it through the second. And now we're going to skip to the other side of the bookend, the last verse of chapter 8 into chapter 9. So for those who haven't been reading the scroll of Esther on your own, I'm sorry because we just skipped the whole story. But I'm assuming you've read it a couple times.
Every year.
And every year we still read it.
At least in this day.
Okay. Let's see, where are we? We are in chapter 8. Why am I starting here? It's a good question. I think there has been a lot of misunderstanding of chapter 8 and 9 of the Scroll of Esther. And as I was trying to prepare myself for this morning, I thought about where some of that misunderstanding may come from. But maybe we should start with a prayer, and then we'll dig into it. Lord, thank you for this day, the nice weather, for Purim, and a reminder that you can do amazing things even when we don't at first see it. We don't see your physical hand. And you don't always show flashes of light, but you are working. And we pray that you would work in us and bring your salvation and your rest more and more to each of us. In Jesus' name, amen. How you read the scroll of Esther, as I mentioned last week, because it's subtle, anything where the author relies on your sense of artistry and your intelligence, it's risky. Because if you don't have a sense of artistry or intelligence, you may miss some important things that may lead you to the wrong conclusions. But so your attitude really affects a lot of how you read this story. And even scholarship, you see that when you read explanations of the different verses, you can see their initial assumptions and how it's led them one way or another. It's the same words everyone's reading, but completely different interpretations based on their starting point. And so, I'll just say that as a pre-note, as you come to reading text, especially a text you might find difficult in the Bible, be extra aware of the attitude you approach a text with, because that will affect how you read it. And so I'm telling this to myself, let's not give ourselves too many airs of being so objective when no one really is. But we can choose to align ourselves and say, you know, God, show me what this means, because at first it's confusing, or why did this have to happen, or what about this? And if you have the right attitude, I think that you can actually find a lot of things in the details. If you have some negative assumptions, you will read between the lines, but in a negative way. Either way, basically, we have to read between lines. That's literature. So, without further ado, let's read the lines themselves. Let's start. A good place to start is Mordecai's decree.
So your age was...
Okay. Let's start at verse 10. Or verse 9. Chapter 8.
You want somebody to read it?
Yes, I would like someone to read it.
8:10. 8:9. Mordecai wrote in the name of King Xerxes, sealed the dispatches with the king's signet ring, and sent them.
Verse 9.
Just start verse 9 if you don't mind, yeah.
Verse 9, chapter 8.
Mm-hmm.
Esther, that goes way back to. Once the royal secretaries were summoned on the 23rd day of the third month, the month of Sivan, they wrote out all Mordecai's orders to the Jews and to the satraps, governors and nobles of the 127 provinces, stretching from India to Kush. These orders were written in the script of each province and the language of each people, and also to the Jews in their own script and language. Mordecai wrote in the name of King Xerxes, sealed the dispatches with the king's signet ring, and sent them by mounted couriers who rode fast horses, especially bred for the king. The king's edict granted the Jews in every city the right to assemble and protect themselves, to destroy, kill, and annihilate any armed forces of any nationality or province that might attack them and their women and children, and to plunder the property of their enemies. The day appointed for the Jews to do this in all the provinces of King Xerxes was the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar. A copy of the text of the edict was to be issued as law in every province and made known to the people of every nationality, so that the Jews would be ready on that day to avenge themselves on their enemies. The couriers, riding the royal horses, raced out, spurred on by the king's command, and the edict was also issued in the citadel of Susa. Mordecai left the king's presence wearing royal garments of blue and white, a large crown of gold, and a purple robe of fine linen, and the city of Susa held a joyous celebration. For the Jews, it was a time of happiness and joy, gladness and honor. In every province and in every city wherever the edict of the king went, there was joy and gladness among the Jews, with feasting and celebrating, and Gemma wearing red clothing. Oh, no,
pink.
And
pink,
many
pink,
peoples
pink,
of the nationalities became Jews because fear of the Jews had seized them, and seized Gemma.
Sorry, what translation are you reading?
This is the student New International.
Okay, does anyone else have a different translation?
Which verse?
End of verse 17. Many people became...
Many of the resident peoples pretended to be Jews because the fear of the Jews had overcome them.
And what...
I've got many people of other nationalities became Jews because fear of the Jews had seized them.
And which one were you reading?
Net.
Yeah, net. That's right. I have net too. They pretended.
What is net?
It's a online Bible.
What does N-E-T?
It's like a translator's Bible.
Is it
New English?
New English translation?
No. It's.
I don't know what the.
Oh, I see.
It stands for something.
Right.
But it has notes on the translation. It's available online.
It's got translator notes.
So there are always these footnotes by, like, for instance, this word, the resident peoples pretended. You can put your cursor over it. Should tell you something. Not telling me anything. Okay, here we go. We're becoming Jews.
What's pretend? What's the word in Hebrew for pretend?
Mit yahadim. They are making themselves Jews. It's a word you could say. Are they making themselves Jews in earnest, or are they making themselves Jews that other people would think they were Jews because, you know, just out of fear? So that's affecting the translation, whether you say they pretended to be Jews or they actually, we're talking about mass conversions. And we're going to, Yeah, we'll stop at the end of that verse and discuss some of this. First of all, what's going on here? What is Mordecai's decree?
That they can defend themselves against attackers, and I've never noticed that until now.
Yeah.
I always thought there was something quite aggressive about the whole thing.
Now that's a very big key to notice.
Yeah.
Because without that, it would be quite a gruesome little book.
That's right.
Okay, so Mordecai, if you've read through the scroll, which we haven't this morning, you'll see that his edict, his decree he sends out, is a very, very close reversal of Haman's edict.
Mm.
And Haman's was the original. He has this plan to get rid of the Jews, and he sends a royal decree out, and it specifies it. So just look back to Esther 4:3. Go ahead and do that so we have the actual words in our mind. Okay, well, that's after the actual edict. Okay, let's go up to chapter 3. I'm reading from chapter 3, verse 12. Everything Haman commanded was written to the king's satraps and governors who were in every province, and to the officials of every people, province by province, according to its script, and people by people, according to its language. In the name of King Ahasuerus, it was written and sealed with the king's signet ring. Letters were sent by the runners to all the king's provinces, stating that they should destroy, kill, and annihilate all the Jews, from youth to elderly, both women and children, on a particular day, namely the 13th day of the 12th month, that is, the month of Adar, and to loot and plunder their possessions. A copy of this edict was to be presented as law throughout every province. It was to be made known to all the inhabitants so that they would be prepared for this day. The messengers scurried forth with the king's order. The edict was issued in Susa, the citadel. While the king and Haman sat down to drink, the city of Susa was in an uproar. Susa is the name for Shushan. And of course, Mordecai mourns after that. So you have the initial edict. What was the goal of the edict? What are the three words?
Destroy, kill, and annihilate.
Yeah. To kill, destroy, and annihilate. Lehashmid, laharog, uleabed. Pretty inclusive. They want young and old, and they want specifically women and children also, everything. And to plunder all their possessions.
Sounds like the Shoah.
Sounds like the Shoah. Yes, it does. We, in our time, can look back in history to something like this that actually happened. I was thinking that's also interesting how we interpret the scroll of Esther. Because if you had been living in generations before the Holocaust, this might all sound like as if that could ever happen. Or as if anyone would actually ever do that. Like a great big exaggeration. But we actually have a historical figure who tried to do this very thing. And it's pretty amazing. And there are some people who try to pretend it didn't happen in history, but I have seen the piles of shoes of little kids and the bones of people that were boiled as experiments on dwarfism. I mean, there's just museums full of stuff. You can go to Auschwitz, you can go to Birkenau, you can visit these places.
You can go to
Yad Vashem here in the land.
You can watch the speech on YouTube from last week with Bibi, who asked Elie Wiesel to stand
up. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah, there are still people who personally experience it. So 100% verifiable, this can actually happen.
But what does it say if there are people denying it? What does it say about the human condition?
It's pretty bad.
Great denial.
Memory is a very tricky thing.
Well, and is it, are we actually talking about memory? I think that's doing it a credit.
Well, we're talking about erasing memory. People who don't admit what has happened are rewriting history based on what they want to remember as fact. So it's in my mind still in the category of memory. Although you're saying they don't admit their...
I was not in the Shoah. I did not see. I've not never been to Auschwitz.
Mm-hmm.
So one could argue that to actually say that it happened is not actually my memory.
No, it's collective memory.
Okay, collective memory. We're getting better.
Collective memory.
Collective memory.
And that's part of why we have feasts and celebrations, is to remember certain things.
That's very good.
Yeah.
So you can say the same about Passover.
Yeah. I was not in Egypt personally, but I can remember it as being grafted into the descendants who were there.
Right.
So you have this terrible edict that goes out, and so it's no wonder the verses we just read are mirrored. They're the exact replication to the positive. So Mordecai gives now permission to the Jews to stand up to those who would try to do this edict. And if you remember, according to the laws of Persians, you know, nothing can be changed. So this first edict is still in place, but now the Jews are legally allowed to stand up and defend themselves. Which made me ask myself a question, would they not have been legally allowed before? But it's an interesting question, because if the king is issuing it, this is official and government ordered, so to speak. So to stand up against the government is often interpreted as
rebellion
or treason or some reason to be
But there's a difference, isn't there, between what you would call the rebellion, let's say, of the midwives who rebel against Pharaoh, who says you're to kill all the babies. And what we now know about the law of the Medes and Persians, which when the law of the Medes and Persians was issued, whichever king, I assume, it's fixed. So you need another edict to say, if you are attacked under a perfectly legitimate law, you now have a right to defend yourself.
Yeah, and they obviously, the Persians, you see throughout the scroll, they have a very elaborate networking and official bureaucracy system set up. And even if their king is a complete moron and like a puppet at best, given to flippancy of his own whims, their system is actually very efficient in getting word out. Yeah, wine, women, and whatever. They have an efficient system. And that's kind of ironic. But look at the response then. So you have this exact reversal. Mordecai's words exactly parallel Haman's words. And then look in chapter 4, if you're still there. 4 verse 3. What is the response of the Jews?
And every promise to which the edict and order of the king came, there was great mourning among the Jews with fasting, weeping, and wailing. Many lay in sackcloth and ashes. By the way, what's the word in Hebrew for sackcloth?
Sack. Sack. Mm-hmm.
And ashes?
Ephel.
Just like in Jonah.
So I'm going to write Esther 4:3. This is in Hebrew. In English, it's different. So you have mourning of the Jews. You have mentioned in every province, v'chol medina u'medina, mekom asher davar ha'melech v'dato magia.
So where are you now?
In chapter 4, verse 3 and following. Evel gadol layehudim v'tzom uvechi umisped. So a great mourning for the Jews, fasting, crying, and mourning. Sak ve'efer, sackcloth and ashes being given out to many. So you have all these verbal parallels if you read in Esther 8, who wants to read Esther 8:17 now? Is someone with English? Esther 8, verse 17.
In every province and in every city, wherever the king's command and his edict came, there was gladness and joy among the Jews, a festival and a holiday. Furthermore, many of the peoples of the country professed to be Jews because of fear of the Jews had fallen upon them.
So instead of Evel and Sak, you have Simcha and Sasson.
Yeah, so here you have mourning of the Jews, here you have gladness. This is Evel. I'll write it in a nice little Ulpan script. Sasson. Or, sorry, Simcha first. You got all the ones in there, but rejoicing, happiness. So, that parallel, you have the exact Bechol Medina Umdina Bechol Ir Ve'ir. These phrases are exactly replicated. Sorry, except the Ir Va'ir is only in Esther 8. Each city is in the Esther 8 one, not in Esther 4. Evel Gadol becomes Simcha Vesason. So the great mourning becomes happiness and joy. Som Uvechi Umisped becomes Mishte Ve'yom Tov. So, let's see, I'll say fasting and crying become feasting and a good day, which we can call a holiday. And even down to here you have sackcloth and ashes being offered to the rabim, to the many. And here you have also a many, but it's different now. It's many of the peoples of the land become Jewish. So literally you have a bunch of links, exact reversals, and yet with a little bit of a spin. So back to this issue we touched on before, many peoples of the land. Who are these people and what are they doing? What does this mean for us in terms of the story? One thing we could read is Deuteronomy 28:10.
You know what suddenly occurs to me? We're talking about the Shoah. So many Jews in the Shoah tried to get rid of their Jewishness. They tried to get rid of their circumcision. They tried to get rid of their any sign of anything. They even converted to Christianity or Rome or whatever. And here you have the opposite.
Right. At least at this point.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Deuteronomy 28:10.
Then all the peoples on earth will see that you are called by the name of the Lord, and they will fear you.
Okay. So we have this little Amei Haaretz, all the peoples of the world or the land. Haaretz can be very ambiguous how far that stretches. They will see that the name of the Lord is called on you, and they will fear you or respect you. This is Yirah. So keep that in mind. And now let's go back to Esther 8:17. It says, why do they meet Yahadim? Why do they do this mass conversion or pretend to be Jews or whatever happens?
Save their skins.
Because? Nafal Pahad. Fear fell on them. So a different word for fear, but the same idea that they are in awe of something. They're afraid of something. And Nachal Pahad keeps coming. Pahad is your word for fear here. In Deuteronomy, it's Yirah, Yareh. So this one comes three times in Esther. We have it in this the verse we're reading, Esther 8:17. And then we'll read the next couple of verses, I think, in 9:2 and 9:3. So three times fear falls.
It's interesting, I mean, maybe you're going to go into this, but they're just told they can defend themselves.
Yeah.
So why would people be afraid of them? If they're not going to attack them, they're not going to be reverse attacked, you know? If you just stay in your house, they don't need to defend themselves against you.
Well, that's a good question. They are allowed, they're given permission to defend themselves, anyone attacking them. So what's there to be afraid of? Just don't attack them. I think maybe...
Well, they're also feeling that it's the law of the Medes and Persians that they do. They haven't annulled that law. You've got
so,
a
like,
date
I'm
and
forced
a time.
To attack?
Well, you've been given a date, and that's the date
take.
You're to go and do... your. This is the day you're to go and do your killing and your annihilating and your destroying and your plundering.
Or if you assume someone's going to attack, and what if I'm caught in the middle of it? Or you assume that, hey, they're humans. They might feel vengeance and want to... Even if we don't attack, but they know who was going to attack, they might come get us.
The same thing happened in Germany, really.
So that fear, kind of like a projection. Well, this is what we are going to do to them, so now that they have permission, they're going to come do it to us. And in truth, they are allowed to do it. It says they're allowed to go plunder.
Well, what's interesting to me is that they are given permission to kill women and children. But taken together with the defending themselves, one assumes they would kill women and children if women and children actually come and attack them.
Exactly,
which is
yeah.
kind of unlikely, but does happen. You know, boys throwing stones and things like that happens.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing, because the women and children, back to our attitude when we approach the text, a lot of people, you know, they start pulling out words from here and there. Like, oh, but how gruesome to attack women and children. It's like, well, they're actually... defending against those who would attack them, including women and children, because Haman's edict included women and children. And like you say, there is a guy who says it's not all women and children, only the women and children who actually attack. So,
but also, if you go back to the original edict of Haman, the women and children
were included.
Are included because
yeah.
we're talking about annihilating. If you want to annihilate a people, and we had
yeah.
this with Hitler, you kill off the children.
Wait, are you saying women and children are people too? Not just men?
Well, men.
I totally agree with you.
You're trying to annihilate everybody, so let's stop
yeah.
the people who are going to give birth to the next generation and the ones who are going to grow up and become the next lot of fighters or whatever.
Yeah, so there's the two things there. There's the exact reversal that reflects the women and children of Haman's edict.
Ones that are taking on and doing it.
And you can say it's very...
I'm simply saying your comment is good. It's very bad.
It's very equal here then. If even if you're a woman or a child, let's say the men say, okay, we're not going to attack, but we're going to send out our women and children. Well, that counts too. Like there's a sub-clause that's going to cover that as well. So it's being equal to everyone in that sense. Let us read more about the fear falling. Okay, so we get three mentions of falling fear, and they seem to be spreading out and widening. So someone read that last line of verse 17 on to Esther until verse 3, Esther 9, verse 3. So 8:17.
In every province and in every city to which the edict of the king came, there was joy and gladness among the Jews with feasting and celebrating. And many people of other nationalities became Jews because fear of the Jews had seized them. On the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, the edict commanded by the king was to be carried out. On this day, the enemies of the Jews had hoped to overpower them. But now the tables were turned and the Jews got the upper hand over those who hated them. The Jews assembled in their cities in all the provinces of King... I've got Xerxes here, I'm afraid. To attack those determined to destroy them. No one could stand against them because the people of all other nationalities were afraid of them. And all the nobles of the provinces, the satraps, the governors, and the king's administrators helped the Jews because fear of Mordecai had seized them. Mordecai was prominent in the palace, his reputation spread through the provinces, and he became more and more powerful.
Okay, so it's interesting. This guy, who, by the way, I recommend, Yonatan Grossman, he has this book called Esther Megillat Starim, Esther, the Scroll of Secrets. And he also has a commentary in English, and I always forget the exact title. It's not exactly the same, just like they do in movies here. But Jonathan Grossman.
He's American.
He's American. Is he?
Was an original book written in English?
I don't know. He might be Israeli. The way he writes Hebrew, I don't know.
Is it the same Grossman who writes novels?
No.
No. Different one. He teaches at Bar Ilan, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. He wrote a very nice, this is kind of like somewhere in between academic and popular. It's a book. There are footnotes, but you can just read it like a book. And his commentary is very nice. Anyway, I mention him because
it's written in Hebrew, or is the original?
This is the original. He wrote it in Hebrew, and then he wrote one in English.
All right.
That's even better. More supposedly technical.
Oh.
But, I mean, you can always ignore footnotes.
Can we just go back to this word fear a minute? It's pachad all the way.
Yeah, these three are all pachad. Which is, you know, fear.
Yeah.
You could say it's a synonym of yirah. But here it's three times, and so he's showing how his theory of the three times, it's emphasis and it's widening circles. Because your first pachad is on the people of the land, and then it's on all the something or other, and adding the all is widening it. And then your third is for him the key to understanding it. And that's, instead of pachad of the Jews, it's pachad of Mordecai. Okay, so goes from many of the peoples, to all the leaders of the state, and then fear of Mordecai. And why is it so frightening? Why is Mordecai producing so much fear?
Because he's powerful.
He's powerful. And remember, these edicts are going out months before the actual day of Adar. So everybody, Haman's whole office, this is all very organized. He has a date set aside for destruction. It's all very much final solution. Think about Hitler. Like, there is a plan, and it doesn't just happen. You can't get rid of that many people without a good, efficient plan. Haman's got a plan. He's got people set up everywhere. And when Haman gets all of a sudden taken out of the picture, his office goes to Mordecai. So everyone who's working with Haman now knows that Mordecai's in position. So what does Mordecai have access to? The plans. The lists of all the people who are involved. Stockpiles of weapons. Like, everything, all the details are now in Mordecai's control.
This would be like if a Jewish person during World War II took over Eichmann's job.
Yeah, like, who wouldn't be afraid? If you were on Haman's team, you should be very afraid.
I just add here a very dubious footnote I've never even thought about. Why isn't God mentioned? Because Mordecai and Esther probably were not people of outstanding faith. They didn't leave Persia where the pagans and everything. They stayed there because of that. And they're probably more worried about their finances than returning to the other land.
You should have been here last week, David.
No, he said he's reading a footnote.
I've never heard of that. That's a footnote. I've never heard
that's
that
interesting.
Comment before. Terrible.
Yeah.
As if they didn't have faith, okay?
Right.
I guess all of the Jews' enemies didn't get wiped out.
The whole artistry thing was a little bit lost for them there. Especially if you're going to read Deuteronomy 28:10, it's somehow in the background of people's mindset. That all Amei Ha'aretz will see that the name of the Lord is written on you. It's not even, you don't even have to say it. It's like the people are just going to see that you are different in this verse. And the name of the Lord is written on you. You know, where You don't have to say it. You don't have to do anything or dress a certain way. It's going to be obvious.
That's beautiful, actually, isn't it?
So, yeah, it is kind of.
It should be true for all of us.
All right. So, we don't have a manual with us today, but I also think about strife in Nigeria that goes back and forth, because after visits there, they talk about stockpiling weapons.
Right.
And different cities, you know, they have Christian communities and Muslim communities. And
the Christian communities are stockpiling just as fast as the Muslims.
Well, originally, yeah, I guess it depends. But there are these weapon stockpiles that everybody knows about. Nobody does anything until there's like some little event that they can blame, and then all the stockpile comes out. Anyway, so thinking about this plan to kill all the Jews everywhere, this is pre-atomic bombs, so you're going to need a lot of people involved and a lot of weapons involved. And they have to be somewhere. You have to start accumulating them. So that's what we're talking about here. And now Mordecai is in charge of these things, and he knows where they are. Or at least he knows where they are at the point Haman stepped out. If you're still on Haman's team, you may be scrambling to change their location before Mordecai gets there. But there is fear because of this.
Or to even change your identity. I think of the Nazi rat lines, you know, that you don't want to be known anymore as Haman's.
Yeah, what happened to the Nazis? They all fled to South America changed their names.
Right.
And I don't know if maybe they burned their thumbprints. I don't know what they did to escape.
The combination of Rome and the CIA.
Now, so let's keep reading verses chapter 9. Okay, no one was able to stand before them, for the fear fell on all the people. I like that too. There's a lot of standing, falling motifs in this story. I think it goes back to the Amalekite battle. But that's another Bible story.
Where's the all falling?
I just read from verse 2 again.
Oh, right.
And then 3, in all the provinces, at the end of 3, for the dread of Mordecai had fallen on them. Mordecai was of high rank in the king's palace, and word about him was spreading throughout all the provinces. His influence continued to become greater and greater. Okay, so Esther 9:5. The Jews struck all their enemies with the sword, bringing death and destruction, and they did as they pleased with their enemies. In Shushan, the capital, or the citadel, the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men. In addition, they also killed Parshandata, Dalfon, Asfata, wow, this is hard in English, wait.
Uratha.
Parshandata, Dalfon, Asfata, Porata, Adalia, Aridata, Parmashta, Arisai, Aridai, Yezata, the 10 sons of Haman. Okay, so when did the 10 sons of Haman die?
Basically only at Purim.
On the day of the edict.
Right.
But
they did not lay their hands on the plunder, so they did kill the sons. But you were talking, I think, quite rightly about all the other henchmen who weren't the sons. He must have had a whole bunch of others, quite apart from
And them. Apparently, it says the 10 sons of Haman, son of Hammedata, the enemy of the Jews. Okay, but they did not confiscate their property.
Right.
Okay, so let's do a little tally here. We have, how many people died? 500.
In Shushan.
So this is the capital. And presumably, your higher up people are going to be in the capital. And these are the people that are going to be most involved. So in terms of enemies of the Jews, they killed 500 people.
They also killed the 10 sons. So.
And of those 500 people, they killed 10 sons of Haman.
They also killed. So
right.
If it wasn't also in Hebrew?
Yeah, no, they also killed 10 sons of Haman.
Not only that, after they killed them, they crucified.
Sorry, what?
They crucified.
But not yet. Here, on this day, they killed them.
And that was after they killed them.
They killed them. It says they struck them with the sword, bringing death and destruction. They killed and destroyed 500 men. Did they kill and destroy 500 women and children?
It doesn't say so.
No, it does not say so. 500 men. So you got.
Presumably, those people had attacked them.
Exactly. 500. And was there a nationality given?
No.
No. These are enemies, attackers. So this is not a racist thing. This is not, you know, let's just be bloodthirsty and go out and get everyone. It's 500 men who were their enemies. Now, how do they know who were their enemies?
They must have attacked.
Again, Mordecai has access to all the plans. So this is not random killing. They actually know who their enemies are. Just like after the Holocaust, you knew who was in charge of what, where in the Nazi regime. Because, you know, there's written information. It's actually documented. And Mordecai is in a position to access those plans. So
you
then,
down to verse 15, where they killed 300 more.
Yes,
that's
what. On that same day, the number of those killed in Susa the citadel was brought to the king's attention. Once again, this is not just random vengeful killing. They're showing the king, which is ironic because this king probably doesn't care even half as much as even a fraction of what he should care. But nevertheless, they follow protocol and they bring it to his attention. And it's all very documented, very official. There's nothing, there's no chaos here in that sense. Then the king said to Queen Esther, "In Susa the citadel, the Jews have killed and destroyed 500 men and the 10 sons of Haman. What then have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? What is your request? It shall be given to you. What other petition do you have? It shall be done." And Esther replies, "If the king is so inclined, let the Jews who are in Susa be permitted to act tomorrow, also according to today's law. And let them hang the 10 sons of Haman on the gallows." Now, this can also be interpreted as, oh, you know, you just want your extra little vengeance. Why do you need another day? And like, what's your problem, bloodthirsty Esther? One day isn't enough for you? And I would say, people who come with that attitude, that might be a problem. You're not going to be unbiased in finding an answer. But if you think about it, there are answers. I was thinking about it, back to this idea that there is a plan set in place that was way in advance. The people, the bad guys, now know Mordecai is in power, and it says fear has fallen on them, right? And so what would you do? You say, hey, I know that the 13th of Adar, everyone's going to be out looking for me. Would you walk out in the street on the 13th of Adar?
No.
No. You get your family, you go into hiding, right?
But by the 14th, you might be feeling a bit more blasé.
At least you've passed the legal date. Like, that was the date for it to happen.
And it was one day.
14th, we're safe. We can all come out of our hiding holes.
It's only one day. It's only one day.
It's one day.
It's only one day.
And so Esther...
Not the beginning of a purge.
No.
Esther could very well be saying, hey, I know that day was set aside, and we did get 500. We were able to pull them out of their holes. But there's still some more left, and we would like one more day to be legally get those other people. And so it can be seen as a very realistic thing to ask for a second day. It also happens to tie into the second everything in the scroll, which is nice, but so is nice.
But they have to get attacked on that second.
Yeah, or be enemies. Does it say attacked or enemies?
It says enemies.
Yeah. So they killed 300 more.
You're obviously going to get to verse 16.
And in both cases, you'll notice no plunder. Okay, they were allowed to take plunder, but they didn't.
75,000.
No plunder is specifically mentioned, and of course the women and children are not mentioned, that any women and children died. Both cases. Here we have a total so far in the capital of 800 men.
810, because you've forgotten the sons.
Oh, okay. Unless you view the sons as enemies of the Jews, and then they're included in that 800. But if you want 810, Okay.
Well, it's very clear that as well as they killed the sons.
Now, the other thing about hanging them up, they've already been killed the first day. The second day, Esther asked to hang up the king's sons. You could say that's just to shame them, which is all maybe good and well. But there may have also been a political strategy that, if you remember, Biktan and Teresh were the two people who went against the king at the beginning of the story. What do we call that? Rebels or treason?
Traitors.
They're traitors.
Conspirators.
So, what if Esther is saying, call anyone who makes this plan is actually a traitor? So that it gives more power. You're saying, not only are you going against the Jews if you line up with Haman's side, you're going against the king. And that always carries penalty of death. And so what you're doing by hanging up those 10 people is you're ensuring that people aren't going to try this stunt again. And possibly you're helping the populace help you find those leftover people who you didn't get to. Because this is in the second day when you're trying to get these other 300 people. And you're saying, by the way, everyone on Haman's side is a traitor. And so if you know where the traitors are, you better show them. And you can do that by skewering them. That's the sign of this public shameful death of a traitor. So that's an interesting interpretation to me of why the 10 sons of Haman are hanged on the gallows. Okay, and then the last thing we need to read, verse 16. The rest of the Jews who were throughout the provinces of the king assembled in order to stand up for themselves and to have rest from their enemies. They killed 75,000 of their adversaries, but they did not confiscate their property. All of this happened on the 13th day of the month of Adar. Then they rested on the 14th day and made it a day for banqueting and happiness. Okay, but the Jews who were in Susa assembled on the 13th and 14th days and rested on the 15th, making it a day for banqueting and happiness. So, you have 75,000 here in all the provinces from India to Sudan. Is this a big number?
No, not by the size of the...
Well, everything's relative, right? So it's a big number when you're thinking about sandwiches to eat. But when you're thinking about battles and huge empires, this is very moderate.
75,000?
Yeah. Kingdoms and empires, it's moderate.
127.
It depends how many per city or something.
Compare it to Abia, the king of Israel, who killed 500,000 chosen men in 2 Chronicles 13:17. 500,000 compared to 75,000. That gives it a different perspective.
The angel killed 185,000.
What?
The angel.
Right.
In one night killed 185,000.
Right.
If you compare it to wars and battles and numbers in the Bible, this is not exaggerated or anything
outrageous.
And just as a final thought, I also want you to leave with the idea that the holiday of Purim comes from this initial relief, the day after everyone celebrates their survival. They don't celebrate that these people had to die. They celebrate their survival. And so for all generations afterward, the day set for the celebration is the day after the battles, not the day of the battles. So there's not like this bloodthirsty, we conquered them, isn't that great? No, we were relieved from our enemies. We survived. We made it through. And so there's all these subtle little ways that Esther is telling us this. And if you ask the wrong question or you point to the wrong thing, you can make a caricature that would be incorrect with what actually was trying to be communicated. So that was my goal this morning, is to put some of that in perspective and celebrate the salvation. So we need to go downstairs to the worship service.
Can I just mention something?